grace and faith were used on us, not by us.
The gospel of grace.
You are the thing that was in the mind of God.
The gospel of peace.
This plan was put together by God and Jesus before the creation of anything else.
That was Mike Williams, and this is the Gospel Revolution.
Welcome to the Gospel Revolution Powercast for Friday, December 21. 21? Heck, that's only 4 days short of December 25. But it's December 21, 2018, broadcasting from the home of redemptionism, where we help you reclaim who you really are and help you remember what you didn't know you'd forgotten. We're coming to you from the Gospel Revolution Studios right here in Cullman, Alabama, where we say that a text without a context is a pretext for a subtext. But right now from Oak Ridge, Tennessee, where the Oak Ridge Boys come from, with more consistent, persistent, repetitive CPR of the gospel is the president and founder of the Gospel Revolution, Michael Williams. Should we be opening with an Oak Ridge Boys song, do you think, mate?
No, if we're going to play off of Oak Ridge, let's open up with the sound of an atom bomb going off. I mean, that's...
Okay. So you don't want Dolly Parton, which is only a hop, skip, and a jump from you. You don't want Elvira.
She's just up the street almost. Oh, my gosh. But hey, give me what we're known for, really, and we'll go with it.
How you doing, Michael?
I'm doing very good. Things on the ranch here are smoothing out quite nicely. It has taken 5 weeks up until now for them to get to where they are. And I think that virtually every day, every week, things are getting more in order for the benefit of my sister. She is one happy camper. She really is.
Oh, that's great.
And she is happy and peaceful. And as long as we can keep that combination going, we can deal with anything.
And so, how old is she again?
She's 75.
Mate, when I'm 75, if I am happy and peaceful, it'll be all I want. I won't want any more.
Who wants to remember anything anyway? I mean, yeah.
You got that right.
Memory is cranked up to be way more than it ought to be. Goodness gracious. Some people are suffering because they remember too much.
Well, as Bob Hope said, thanks for the memories.
Oh, Lord, here we go.
Okay. Now, if I've got this right, we are at week one of the, what do we call it, Hebrews? Debunked and exposed, or what?
Hebrews. Catapulted into the 21st century directly from the first century. How that's for a title.
If I can fit it on the top of the page, it sounds great. It sounds really, really good. It's like, you remember those books when we were kids, you'd read an old, old book, 100 years older than us, and every chapter was titled something different. The Extraordinary Discovery, in which we find that such and such and so and so did such and such to someone. And then you'd get this essay of a title and you felt exactly. You'd already read it. Well, we're talking about Hebrews, and we're just going to launch straight in, I suppose. How do we do that? How do we start a book?
Well, you know, I think a run-up is what we need right here, because I want to really establish in ourselves and our listeners a real powerful comparison. We want to approach this in a dialectic way, as was Paul's way. This book is filled with dialectic. If Paul didn't write it, there was somebody with his brain that did. One of the first points that we could make is that there is no record as to who actually wrote this book, but we're not going to become obsessed with that. Personally, I am convinced it was Paul, without a shadow of a doubt. Others are not so convinced, but they're hard pressed to come up with someone else. The number one, the dialectic teaching of this is very fingerprint of Paul and his manner of teaching. Someone with the detailed understanding of the law, of the covenants, of all of it. We know it wasn't written by any of the other disciples. I am totally convinced of. Yep. Those guys did not have the equipment nor the knowledge of the scriptures that is contained here in Hebrews. So write those off. You can write anybody else you want in, but please don't put one of the disciples in here because they would not have had a clue. In fact, I'm actually convinced that the book of Hebrews was written to counter the teachings of Peter, James, and John. Now, you'll see why I say that as we go into this book, but I really am convinced that the writer of this book was not happy with the prevailing doctrine that was emerging from the disciples. Can't really just say the early church because there was a lot that was emerging from the early church, and Paul's ideas really were at the forefront, and so a lot was going on. And the doctrines that are addressed here, though, we are going to give you the DNA of it, their connections. The ones that they are opposing are doctrines of Peter, James, and John all the way through this book. So we hope to have a lot of fun with it. But what we want to do, I think, you know, I was thinking about this. We do know that this is about better covenant, the ultimate completion or perfection of this new and living way that has been established for us, not with us. This covenant has nothing to do with you except that the fact it was done for you. You were never involved. You did not do something to get rid of your sins, your confession, your repentance. Sin was done away with before you were born on this planet. And that's what Hebrews really affirms. So what I would like for us to do, Don, is to take a look at the first creation, which is listed in Genesis, and this really is about the completion of the last creation, the last Adam, if you will, that brought in this last covenant that was actually established in Abraham and fulfilled in Christ. This is, I feel like I've got a ton of things that we're just saying right now that we consider as established truths of the gospel revolution. And we've taught in detail on all of these things that I have mentioned, but we're wanting to put them into this great big mural. It's going to be kind of like standing back and looking at the paintings of the First Congress. That portrait is huge. It is humongous. And it's going to kind of be like that. We're going to try to, each of those characters are well-defined, even though it's a little stretch on the story of history in that particular portrait that was done. And so we're going to try to do this comparison between the first creation and the last creation. This has been we do know that there has been perfection, whatever degree, completion, perfection as far as no such thing as sin and all of these things, and that righteousness has been established. We know that those things have all been done. So, Don, I'm not even sure we need to read a verse in Hebrews yet. I guess we could. What do you think?
Well, let me just pick up on what you're saying. And I'll just backtrack a little bit, if I can, Mike. I think Paul's fingerprints are all over this book when you look at the logic that is employed to make the points that are made in the book. It's so Pauline, it's not funny. Did he use somebody else, a scribe, to write it? Who knows? Some of the words are not the words that Paul would use, but then if I was asking you to convey to my sister a letter, I'd say such and such and such. You might change a word here and there. And I'm as convinced as you are as to the authorship of this letter. The other thing about this letter that strikes me is the quality of the person who wrote it. This was a Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
There was no question about it. He was a Hebrew. And who was he writing to? He was writing to, surprise, Hebrews. Which is, yeah.
So, <Da-da-da-da-da>.
And as we go through this book, we, I think, will discover that the writer is writing to Hebrews who, in times of stress and having come into the new way or the way or the ideals of Jesus, having come into that, they're now thinking of going back under the old Judaism.
Clearly, this is their consideration.
Yeah, so that is probably all the background we need to give about this book. But moving on to what you just referred to, the original creation and the second creation, there are some telling things here. And the reason I say they're telling is because, you know, things are never as they appear in your rearview mirror. You know that some rearview mirrors, they always say, objects are closer than they appear in this mirror. Well, that's how I found when I started digging into some of these things. You and I had a conversation and I went to work and I discovered some things I didn't expect. Now, let's have a look at the first creation. God made this and it was good. God made that and it was good. God looked over the whole 7 days and it was very good.
Yeah, very good.
Very good, yeah. Now, that word good is translated, and what I've done is I've leant heavily on the Septuagint here, and the reason I have is because the Septuagint is our link between the Greek and the Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
I am not a Hebrew scholar, but I do know the Greek, and what I can do is I can lean on the expertise of the Jewish fathers who wrote or rewrote the Torah and the Tanakh in Greek. So I can take their words and I can say, okay, well, this is what they thought that word should mean. And I think a good place to start is the statement of Jesus, be ye perfect. He finishes off the Sermon on the Mount by saying, be ye perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Well, that is a big ask. It's a big tell.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge. But let me read you that verse in the Greek. Shall be then you mature, or you shall then be mature, even as the Father of you is in the heavens mature. The thing I want you to get here, listeners, is that this is future tense.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a command, be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. But in fact, the actual Greek reads this way, you shall then be complete even as your Father in heaven is complete.
Oh, that's very good. I love that.
It smacked me around the head for a good 10 minutes until I could quieten down and drink some coffee.
It makes perfect sense in the entire teaching of Christ there also. And with the condition that the human race was in, of course, Jesus certainly knew that perfection, maturity, whatever it meant, was certainly not achievable. And it doesn't surprise me that the Greek bears that out. When I first taught on this, Don, I was using the word perfect. And then, of course, challenging the fact and then going to Hebrews. And then people were challenging me about the word perfect. Oh, it doesn't mean perfect. It means mature. I says, okay, well, it means mature.
Yeah.
Let's read it that way. Be ye therefore mature. How mature do you have to be? As mature as your Father is, which is in heaven. So, pick your poison, mature or perfect. Which one are you comfortable with that you're going to be as equal to God with in?
Well, we know that there were only three people in the Old Testament who were ever called perfect. One was Job. Now, there was somebody, I think Job 1 verse 1 says, and there was this man called Job who was perfect, I think, and righteous or something else. There was Noah who was perfect in all his genes, or if you want to take the King Jimmy, in all his generations. And I think that Shem also was referred to as perfect. Now, we know that this word can't mean perfect because Isaiah later said, and Paul, quoting Isaiah, said the same thing, there is none righteous, no, not one. Now, if perfection is tied up in righteousness, well, you know, what what do you do with that? So, now the Hebrew word translated as perfect is tornum, or is tormin. Yeah, I just proved I don't even know the first thing about Hebrew, and means, among other things, whole, sound, healthful, and mostly having integrity. You know, when we say, oh, that metal beam is giving away, it has lost its integrity, right? That piece of steel. Well, that's what it's talking about. Now, the Septuagint uses the word teleos, same word used in Matthew 5:48, to mean perfect in the sense of complete and entire, in the same way that we call, if a dog has been spayed, we that's not whole. But if he is totally whole, we call that animal whole. It's not, you know, a whole cow is called a bull or a male cow. But a neutered cow is called a steer. So it is referring to that as entire and complete. Now, neither the Hebrew word nor the Greek word carries a connotation that Noah had somehow achieved a state of flawlessness. So this word is not about flawless. In fact, if you wanted the most flawless person, Philippians 3, Paul's self-description is pretty darn flawless for a Jew. So he'd be as flawless a person as we know. But be ye complete, as your Father in heaven is complete. And it reads in the Greek, you shall be. This is Jesus speaking at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. You are going to be complete, just like your daddy in heaven is complete.
Just like God.
Just like God.
Now, regardless of what word you use, there is an implication here that being just like God, that is a goal. But you know, they were striving for perfection under the law, but the law made nothing perfect, as Hebrews states clearly. The law made the priesthood made nothing perfect. There was no perfect priesthood. There was nothing was perfect about this covenant that Christians still invoke with a passion, and forget the perfection and completion that has already taken place in Christ. It really is quite amazing.
Now, there are two other words in Hebrews that are used, kalos, Greek for beautiful. Most of the words in Hebrews that we come across called good are kalos. And then we've got another word called agathos, which is good. So, and then we have teleos, which means complete and mature, whole and missing nothing. So, when we look at the first creation and then compare it to the second creation, we at least know this. There is something incomplete about the first creation.
Mm-hmm. There is imperfection built into the system, and purposely.
Obsolescence?
Yes. Obsolescence is built in, and for a reason, as people now built in obsolescence into things. They do it for a reason, mostly to make you pay for more auto parts down the road. So, and computer parts and blah, blah, blah.
But in the gospel revolution, we have come to the place of saying things like, look, if the Garden of Eden was perfect, not complete, but perfect, I mean flawless, if it was, then how did sin get in there? Why? And did God not see that coming? Did he get side-blinded somehow? Now, I don't want to worship a God like that. I've got no time for a God that creates a whole creation and just doesn't see the obvious happening. So we have come to the place in the gospel revolution of saying that all creation was one step in the evolution of God and man becoming one. And we have identified Calvary as the place which we would say was a culmination of creation or the fruition of creation or something like that.
And Paul really helped us get that, helped to get that point across to us in Romans 8, where he made it very clear that the original creation of Adam was subject to vanity by necessity. Now, he doesn't give a whole hell of a lot of other explanation there, but he does make it very clear that the vulnerability that Adam found himself in to be able to, quote, sin, was built into him. This was not something that, and since it was built into him, it obviously could not have taken God by surprise. Adam seemed to be quite surprised by his actions, but I'm sure God was not surprised by them. I'm sure Eve was not surprised by Adam's actions. You know, it's this husband of mine. Goodness, he screwed up, you know.
I don't know about that. I've heard a few different thoughts about that, and one is, well, it wasn't an, and Paul makes a big deal out of the fact that it wasn't the man that sinned, but the woman. And I've heard people argue that that once she had lost her sheen of glory, once she had had sin screwing around with her, that he had to make the choice, do I want to be with God or want to be with her? I like her. I want to be with her. So he stepped into that sin, if you like, as well. And I've heard a lot of people trying to, well, they're trying to logic their way around the fact that that this was inevitable. Sin was, or what we call sin, was inevitable. Whatever God kicked them out of the garden for was inevitable, it appears.
Regardless of what the incident would have been, whatever the result was inevitable. If there would have been 40 different things that could have happened to bring about the showing of this vulnerability, this ability to fail, as we would say, that regardless of what light that it would shine through, the one thing that is that cannot be avoided is the reality that God made man this way. And that's what Paul was very convinced of. And I think it's one of the elements that makes Paul see the completed work of the cross over and above the disciples. I don't think the disciples saw that Adam and Eve were created vulnerable to corruption. Paul saw that man was created with the ability and was actually corrupt in the fact that he could sin. The corruption did not come in the sin. The corruption was in that he could sin. Because the glory of this new covenant is not that we don't do things much worse than Adam and Eve did, but the fact that those things can never be measured. These are not measures of sin anymore. That's just such a powerful, it's very difficult to find your way through the forest if you don't accept this basic tenth. And I have to say that, Don, you were very instrumental in helping me make this completion. I kind of worked at it from the front backward. I think you worked at it from the front forward. And we both met in the middle somewhere on there. Yeah. I don't even know where that would have been. But it was fun, I can tell you that. And probably one of the best demonstrations of collegial work on a issue that was greater than ourselves.
I like that. Yeah.
And I think the thing that caused it to be collegial is that we did see it. Each of us saw this as bigger than ourselves. So being wrong and or being proven wrong just was not a part of the issue. Folks, you got to understand that's one of the biggest reasons for the current success, the ongoing success, the past success of the gospel revolution. We don't mind finding out we're wrong. We actually get quite excited about it.
So when we move into Hebrews, juxtaposed over against the fact that God created this, God created that, God created everything, and the very best that God got to was it's very good, not it's complete. He never got to it's complete. Mm-hmm. He only got to, I like the look of that.
Don, what are some of the other words? You know, we've benefited greatly in the past on all our Greek and Hebrew studies by actually finding out where that particular word is used in other contexts. And it has given a clarity to some of these words that we just would never have gotten by staying hyper-focused on the verses that we were studying in. So when it uses that term good, can you pull up and maybe look at just maybe a couple of them where that it says something was good?
You bet.
And let's see if it means anywhere near complete.
Well, it's funny you should ask that because I was looking at a verse in the early part of Psalms, I think, where it says, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. That's the way King Jimmy says it. And in fact, when you really dig into the Hebrew, it seems to be saying the law of the Lord is complete, not perfect, not flawless, but complete. Mm. It's funny that the law that God gave, and he only gave it to 6% of the population of the earth at that time, the Jews, the Israelis, I beg your pardon. The Jews are only representative of one tribe, namely the tribe of Judah. But he gave it to them, and David said, I love your law, Lord. It is complete, refreshing the soul. Mm-hmm. In King James it says converting the soul. So David had this concept, not that the law was flawless, but it was complete enough to refresh him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let's have a look at good. And the trick with looking at good is, come here.
Well, we know that Hebrews says that the law could not produce perfection. So that's a very good hint at the insight into David's relationship with God's law. But you know, David was the one who got a revelation of the new covenant. David's the one who said, blessed is the man whom God makes righteous, who hasn't done anything right, and blessed is the man who, when he sins, God doesn't hold it against him. That man with that revelation is speaking these words about how much he loves God's law. He knew where God's law was leading us to. The law was, I would say that Hebrews teaches that the law was perfect in this aspect. It was perfectly appointed to lead us right straight into perfection. Not by the works of the law, but by what the law would deliver us into. The law brought us to Christ. So in that, the law did a perfect work. The law did not do what the Jewish people or the Israelis tried to convert it into. And remember, God never said, if you do this, you'll be righteous. It was the Jewish nation that said, if we do this, this will be our righteousness if we do these things. So the law had this wonderful, revelatory consequence to it. You ain't going to make it. There's got to be something else.
Okay. When we look at, say, Deuteronomy 1, I'm looking at 25, and they took of the fruit of the land in their hands and brought it down unto us and brought us word again and said, it is a good land. We're talking about people describing a country that the Lord is going to lead them into. And it's a good land which the Lord our God gives us. And the word is Tob in the Hebrew. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but...
The same as?
How do you mean? I say, yes, the exactly the same as, and God saw what he made, and it was Tob. It was good.
Yeah, it was good.
Now, let me find another one. Something else, let me see.
So even in that situation, you could not apply complete or perfect?
No.
Because the land is going to go through seasons. It's going to have, weather disasters that happen there. It's going to have extreme cold, extreme hot. It's just like any other place on planet Earth.
So you're not going to describe that like you would describe laying on a hammock in the Philippines, where the water is crystal blue, and that's the way it is. You're not going to do that.
And that's only perfect for a moment, because the next thing you may be hanging onto your hammock and your hat. So
and if it was, yes, very transient, a perfection, if I can say that. Let's have a look at Proverbs. Proverbs is an interesting book, and it'll have something here. So you will find, so I'm reading from Proverbs 3 verse 4, and it says, so you shall find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man. Tov, again, is the word. Somewhere down the road, he says, for I give you good doctrine. It's not perfect, but it's good. I don't know if any of these are really doing what you want.
There, it seemed that there was a couple where it said that so-and-so was good, or this person was good. Or
okay, so here I think we're talking about sacrifices. Go now, this is in Genesis 27, verse 9. Go now to the flock and fetch me from there two good kids or goats.
Mm-hmm.
Unless that goat was, it's two good goats, and I've had goats, and I know there's nothing such as a good goat. I'll tell you. And Rebecca in chapter 27:15 took good raiment of her eldest son Esau, and I am sure that there's no such thing as an absolutely perfect garment. I mean, perfect. When the chief baker saw that the interpretation was good, and we're talking now in Genesis 40 with Joseph in the Pharaoh's prison, he said unto Joseph, I also was in my dream, and so forth. It was a good interpretation. And finally, let me just quote Genesis 39, verse 6. And he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, he's talking about Pharaoh, and he knew not what he had, save the bread which he ate, and Joseph was a good person and well-favored. Joseph was a good person. Now we know from Isaiah that there is none that were righteous.
Right. What we're seeing here is that even in the book of Genesis, the places where this word is used, you cannot possibly view it as the word complete or any variety of the issue of perfection. Good means good. Perfect means perfect. Complete means complete. Incomplete means incomplete. Incomplete can be good.
And any way you want to interpret perfect, it's different than good.
It's different than good. So that's what we were wanting to get to today. And as to establish this fact that good is not perfect and perfect is not good. Perfection, completion, can take good and turn it into something else. But you have to leave good behind. to get to perfect.
We even have this saying in English that good is the enemy of the best. You've got good, better, best, but settling for good is the enemy of getting the best.
Well, so even in our language, then, the term good does wind up actually rivaling the best.
Yes.
You know, if you told somebody at this price, you can get good, better, or best. Which one do you want? No one would go for good or even better than good. They would all go for best.
Top of the line.
Yeah, absolutely. Was there any difference in the price? No, none whatsoever. So.
Yeah, yeah, really.
Oh, well, I think I'll just settle for the good one.
Yeah, I don't deserve any better than I just want. Yeah, yeah, good and perfect. Now, in Hebrews, it's very interesting that the writer distinguishes between a good covenant and a perfect covenant, a good priest and a perfect priest, a good sacrifice and a perfect sacrifice. And again, if God made us incomplete, there is something here in Hebrews that the writer wants us to get. Hey, guess what? Now you're complete. Everything about this thing is complete. There is nothing more. I mean, no wonder Jesus said, "It is finished."
And the writer of this book, again, let us point out, obviously understood the scriptures. He knew he was dealing with a very good creation. He is trying to present a absolutely perfect creation, perfect in this reality. There is no death and there is no ability to corrupt. It's not possible to be corrupted. Adam was created with the ability to be corrupted. And as I said, I think actually the ability to be corrupted is where the corruption lies. It's that it is, that is indeed where it lies. It's in the fact, you know, whether the car breaks down or not doesn't tell you whether or not the car has a malfunction in it. The malfunction is established that it's there whether the car breaks down or not. So the breaking down of the car or, you know, the equipment or whatever it might be, is that's just the manifestation of what was inherent before the breakdown came. You know, even when they do these studies of these tragic plane crashes around the world, you know, it's amazing how many. There's never just one factor that brings down a large jet plane. Now, because each of these, in the investigation of these airline crashes, they find out what was inherently wrong with the airplane that caused three or four things to go catastrophically wrong at the same time that brought the airplane down. Now, what have they done over the years as they have discovered this? They've gone back and redesigned the thing that was inherently corrupt about the design, which only the fault showed, the cataclysmic fault actually revealed that there was something inherently wrong with the design. So again, I don't think the fact that Adam and Eve partook of the fruit was the fault. I think that it's just like the airline. There was a fault that was built in. And now with the airlines, that would have had to have been a mistake or a very diabolical or money-oriented oversight, a deliberate oversight to cut corners or whatever. But you just can't say that about God as a creator. He was not the builder of airplanes. He was the maker of man. And he made him knowing exactly what was faulty. The results of that faultiness is what we see in the book of Genesis. Now, why faultiness? Why would God put faultiness in there. Now, we've got some pictures of this, but then most of it, we just don't have conclusions, folks. But we're okay with that. That's the thing that frustrates a lot of people about Mike Williams Ministries and the Gospel Revolution. We're comfortable if we learn something that leaves 10 things unanswered. In fact, we're quite excited about that because that gives us 10 things to study to see whether the one thing we learned is actually correct or incorrect. And nobody cares which way it's going to turn out. We just don't care. So with this situation being built in, I think, Don, one of the things that we've considered is that God really was looking for a place to live. And he wanted, okay, let's put this thing together. And, you know, it's not, if it's going to be my house, you know, we can even look at it in that term. A house is not perfect till it becomes a home, until it has occupants. You know, the builder can do a great job, but if there's never an inhabitant in that, it is going to decay by virtue of the fact that it is uninhabited. So, man, I tell you what, I kind of see this as the ultimate tailor, the ultimate builder of all things, building a house and saying, this is where I want to live, or that tailored suit. Let's see. I wonder how this is going to look on me. And now, a lot of people don't get excited about that concept. Me, it brings up unbelievable amounts of just passion about truth to think that this process began and that the completed work of all this, we have to remind ourselves again and again and again, was done before he ever built the house that he was going to eventually live in. He let other things occupy and say, you know, let's really test this thing out here. So the human being stayed in that position for a long time until it was time to perfect this, but not perfect it by changing it, perfecting it by inhabiting it.
As John 14, 23, Jesus speaking says, and if you do this, then I will do that. It's a very if-then kind of a statement. Mm-hmm. At the very first verse, he says, behold, I'm going to create a mansion for you. It's the same word in the Greek as in verse 23 where he says, and if you do what I say, then my Father and I are going to come in and make our mansion with you. The fact of the matter is that he has made his mansions and they're us. We are his mansion. We are his stepping up in the world to a better address. We are his the thing that is not now going to fall apart because it's uninhabited. We are inhabited by God himself. And he even took those conditions. Well, if you obey me, if you do this, if you do the other thing, then we'll come in and make our abode with you. He took that and he said, oh, what the heck? I can obey. It's my obedience that's going to make it happen. And we're going to see this in Hebrews. It's my obedience. I'll obey for him. And we're going to, I mean, come hell or high water, we are going to have our abode in man.
Yeah.
Ooh, baby.
That is a, man, I tell you what, there's a whole lot of territory to fill in and to, man, to get this incredible thing going. My gosh. I'm excited. Now, see, what we are going to be doing is we're going to examine this transition all the way from that which was good to that which is perfect.
Oh, yeah.
Man, that's what we're going to be talking about, and we're going to be talking about it in every term that Paul could conjure up out of his brain.
Now, family, that is what you're going to be hearing. If you don't like that, you listen to the wrong podcast.
Just stop listening. Yeah. How did we get from good to perfect? Yeah. How did we get from corruptible to incorruptible? How did we get there? Oh, my gosh. Well, That's enough to get me to come back next week. Don, how about you?
Well, if I can play a little bit of country music. Sure.
Well, I can hear Kentucky calling me, whispering through my halls of memories.
You were very hard on me last week, you know.
I know. And but you pulled your own self out of the fire by at least not playing Elvira.
Oh, man. You're going to get it this week. You are so going to get it this week. Now,
Hebrews 1, chapter 1. Okay. God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spoke in times past unto the fathers by the prophets. That's where this is all going to start. And, man, we're going to have to unpack just the first verse, number one.
Well, let's have a shot at it now. We got plenty of time left if you want.
Let's take a look at it. Let's do verse 1 today, and then we'll do verse 2 next week, verse 3 the following week.
God, who on Sunday times, what's that mean, God, who at sundry times and in diverse?
Well, sundries, you know, the only thing I know of is here in Tennessee, I grew up around sundries, stores that had various things, no specific need. They were sundries, so-and-so's drug and sundries. So it meant that they had more than just a pharmacy. They had sundries. They had various items. So did that come close to being what it is?
I guess. I thought it was, you know, you had to dress up in your sundry best. But God, who at sundry times and in divers manners, what? I don't even want to guess this one.
It is a medieval English word, which we now call diverse.
Oh, okay.
Different.
All right. So God, who at different times and in different ways.
Now, this is speaking quite past tense already, isn't it?
Totally. Spoke in times past.
Now, that word spoke, let's look at that word. I want to make sure we know we are talking about past tense. What is the tense of this word spake?
It's past tense.
It is past tense.
It is past tense in the Greek.
All right, so so then after he assures us that this happened in many different ways, diverse ways, man, God just had a whole bunch of different ways of communicating to us and speaking, but he did this when?
In times past.
Wow. That term is very indicative, again, of Paul. You know, the only one that I find using this term in times past is Paul. He used it in Galatians. He said, you know, I benefited from the Jews' religion in times past. And he comes up to chapter 6 where he's listing all the things that'll keep you out of the kingdom. And he identifies it that this was what was true in times past, that these things were taught. He said, I used to teach you these things. I used to teach you these things. It's interesting that he says, I used to teach you these things in times past, and then comes up with Hebrews chapter 6 about the doctrines that should be left behind. Mm. You see, Paul himself had left those doctrines behind. Paul had left those doctrines behind. And he moved on. The disciples did not.
So God, who at different times and in different ways spoke in times past unto the fathers, the very Jewish term, which in Latin is pater, patros, but in divers manners spoke in times past unto the fathers by the prophets. So, in times past, God was not real long on talking directly to people. He did it through the prophets. Interesting.
That's one of the many different times and one of the divers' manners.
One of the divers' manners. That's why I believe the Bible, because he prophesied divers well before they ever happened.
And one of the many different manners that he did this, he also spake in time past unto the fathers by the prophets. Now, what is the difference, Don, between the fathers and the prophets?
Well, in the Old Testament, in the scriptures, the prophets were the voice of God. The prophets were those, which is why if they prophesied something wrong, you stoned them. They deserved death. Now, the fathers did not always get death when they got things messed up. And the best probable picture is David, when Samuel comes up to him and says, "Well, David, I got a story to tell you." "Oh, yeah, what's that?" Now, this is after David took a shine to a Sheila that was sunbathing on a roof that was a bit lower than the roof of the palace. And then he virtually had her husband murdered so that he could have it away with Bathsheba. So up comes Samuel and says, "You know, there was a farmer and he had a sheep, and another farmer stole his sheep. I mean, who ever heard of such a thing?" And David said, "Get out of here. You bring that bloke to me and I'll have his head for that." Mm-hmm. And Samuel said, "Oh, David, God's talking about you."
Yes.
Now, the difference between the two was that David, although he spoke prophetically, was not what we would have called, that wasn't his full-time job.
Right.
Now and then he kind of dabbled in that hobby, let's say.
So, yeah, and any one of the fathers could have prophesied.
And much in their lives was an inaudible, a silent prophecy. You look at Joseph and his life. That was a silent prophecy of Jesus, if ever there was one. But Samuel, that was his full-time job. He was a prophet. And if Samuel spoke, well, you listened, is what you did. So we know another prophet. There was a king, and he said, "Oh, let me just live another few years." And the prophet said, "Oh, yeah, okay then." And he got 15 more years. So the difference between the fathers and the prophets is the fathers were those who went before, and the prophets were those who were God's voice piece to those fathers.
Awesome. So we have we've established what the difference is, and that these prophets, they did something. But now, what do those prophets, what is that position of a prophet now under the new covenant? Are we still needing prophecies?
Oh, yeah, we got John Hagee. we got Kenneth Copeland. Some very fat people telling some pretty fat lies.
Man, I tell you what, I help my sister by going through some of her inconsequential mail just so that it doesn't bother her.
Oh, don't tell me.
She can take things quite seriously. And there was one in there from, oh my gosh, I am so tempted to write back the most scathing and use every curse word I can find back to these people, telling my sister that, for $150, you can know, what job you're supposed to be in for this amount. You can get the holy water to go with it. And they had a list of these things. They all had a price. Oh, and here's what the total is. But guess what?
What?
All for $25 now. We'll send it all to you just as a gift.
Oh.
All you got to do is send us $25.
It's like Black Friday. I bet people get killed in the scramble for that.
And knowing these people know they're as fraudulent as the day is long, and sending out letters to people like my sister, raping people who are elderly.
That's what they're doing.
I'm telling you. It's in my drawer in there. It's locked away, actually.
Are they Vikings? Do they burn, rape, and pillage?
They do, mentally and emotionally, they do. Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, but we don't have these prophets, the ministry of the prophet. The one of the things that you're going to find out here in Hebrews is the ministry of the prophet, the priest, all of these positions have been fulfilled. The first position that Jesus filled and fulfilled was in the book of Hebrews is this word prophet. He became the prophet. Remember, John was the last prophet up until Christ.
And the Bible says something quite extraordinary. There was no greater man ever born from a woman. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's extraordinary. But these prophets, now in the Word of Faith movement, we used to say that prophecy was still a gift and this so-and-so was a prophet, so-and-so else was an apostle. And we took that to mean that we could be God's voice into people's lives. And people took us seriously. And
goodness, yes.
I don't know how many shipwrecks we created by saying that. But the prophets in the Old Testament didn't do that.
No.
The prophets in the Old Testament, and I don't care what you say, because if modern prophets had any kind of... if they deserve to be in any way taken as serious and credible, at least everything they said would come to pass, because that was a characteristic of a prophet in the scriptures in the Old Testament.
That is true. Now we're finding out here in Hebrews again. As we go through here, you're going to find out how Jesus. You know, I came up with a statement many years ago. Everything that was a what in the Old Testament became a who in the New Testament. Prophecy is a what; it became a who. The high priesthood is a what; it became a who. And only one, and the final one, and the last one. The thing that we always have to remember about the work of Christ is he was the last one, even the Adam. He was the last Adam. He was the last prophet. He was the last high priest. You could have used that terminology that Paul used with the last Adam in any of these applications and find out that it is very correct in using in any one of them. It says he hath, verse 2 says, hath in these last days spoken. In the last days spoken.
Lalio.
In the last days spoken. It does not say in these last days is speaking. Why? Because the last days are over. The last days came and went. They ended with the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. The last days are not in the future. Again, I'm telling you, we are going to rip Christianity anew. And I don't mean to be so graphic, but I'm telling you, I've been to my gospel machine has been suppressed for 5 weeks, and we're ready to tear into this. And please let us make it clear to you, whoever is telling you that the last days are coming, they're just shysters. It's very clear that the last days were going on when Jesus was speaking. Oh, but the Lord's still speaking to us. No, we're not talking about that. This is when Jesus was speaking on earth. When Jesus was speaking on earth, he was taking this entire planet through the last days. The last days of what? Everything we're going to be talking about in Hebrews.
So there. If you want to know what that means, you just kind of have to listen. Has in these last days spoken unto us by his Son. Now, there's no words used there. There is a person that is used. And he doesn't even say... He's spoken not unto us by the words his Son says, or by the Sermon on the Mount, or John 17, where he prayed for. No, he just spoke to us by his Son.
Yes.
We have the revelation, apparently, a better revelation than they had in the old days. when they had prophets. And it comes via his son, whom he has appointed. This is past tense. He has already appointed heir of all things.
And we know he appointed him before the foundation of the world.
That's it. Heir of all things before the foundation.
Mm-hmm. Heir of all things before the foundation of the world.
By whom also he made the world.
Wow.
Worlds before the foundation of the world.
By whom he also made the worlds before the foundation of the world. But now here's the thing that we've got to, we're going to be doing flash forwards all the way through this, and we'll be doing flashbacks just to lace all of this up for you.
Because we're both very, very practiced prophets.
We're very flashy is why. And it says he also was made by whom he also made the worlds. Now, how does Hebrews 11 tell us the worlds were made? By faith, right?
Who's faith?
Well, who else was around? There was only one that was around, and that was Christ. That is the one by whom God made all things. It's by the faith of God, the faith of Christ, this perfect. A perfect, not good, this perfect union of Father and Son here, carrying this out by a perfect faith, not an imperfect faith, not a hope-so faith, not a we're going to try it, and, you know, well, let's all gather together and let's all agree, and maybe it, you know, we're going to get it to happen, then it don't happen, then you got to come up with new doctrines as to why it didn't happen. That's all bull crap, folks. Leave it behind. That's why Paul said, leave this doctrine about faith toward God behind. Leave this doctrine about faith toward God behind.
Who? Being the effulgence or the, it's when it says brightness, who being in the brightness of God's glory, what he's saying is, the word in the Greek means when you see the fireworks on July 4th and you hear the bang, boom, and off goes the rocket. And then suddenly in the sky there's this magnificent, sparkling, gorgeous, all manner of colors. That is the effulgence.
Mm-hmm.
Who, this is a sun, who being the effulgence of God's doxa, glory, and the express image.
Mm-hmm.
The express image of his essence, actually, is the word that is being used here. So you want to know what the essence of God is? Look at the sun. And upholding all things by the word of his power. We tend to say the power of his word. No, it was by the word of his power. His power as a language, I guess. When he had by himself purged our amatia, our sins, sat down on the right hand. Now, he's a Hebrew talking to Hebrews, and later in Hebrews he's going to say, we're going to find out there are three things that happened at the cross, four actually, but three things. One is that Jesus died as a ransom for sins under the First Testament. We're going to find that out. He sat down on the right hand of the majesty, and, oh, man, I just get all carried away with this stuff, mate. You're going to have to stop me.
Well, I think this is as good a place to stop as any here, Don. We've shoveled a lot your way today, folks. And this deserves much closer attention after we got past verse 2. We've got to go through all of these phrases that Don has just read to you. Then, of course, verse 4 goes into being made so much better than the angels. Yeah. So even angels were not perfect. Obviously, can anyone say, obviously, angels were not perfect?
Well, when a third of them decided to skip out of heaven under Lucifer's baton, yeah, I'm thinking you're right.
Yes, and, you know, we kind of diminish people by and children even by saying, oh, look at that perfect little angel. Well, sorry.
No. It's actually, look at that perfect little cherub.
Uh-huh, exactly. So, man, we got a lot to go through, folks. And so you can tell we have bitten off several weeks. I'm also going to be teaching the book of Hebrews in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. This is going to be a Hebrews year.
Well, I'll get me a new coffee maker. I'll try and keep up with you, buddy.
Gospel Revolution.
Oh, thanks, folks, so much for joining us today. We are going to be headed straight along into Pledge Drive in just about another week after this show. Thank you so much for being very much participating in this incredible gospel. We love you. We are absolutely head over heels for you and watching and joining in and participating in your growth in the gospel. It is a privilege. It is an honor. And we hope that you find it a privilege and an honor to invest your funds into this gospel revolution. We're doing a lot. We're doing more every day, and we intend to do more. Everybody was so patient with me, Don, and you during our hiatus of almost 5 weeks. And we know that people understood that there were things that were happening that were just outside of our ability to really change the outcome of this very much while we were busy changing the outcome of some other people's lives. And so we thank you for that. I think that we have a lot of people. We got a message from Vic DeBrennan, and he said, you know, goodness gracious, he said, I'm just so glad you didn't go one more week. I would have been on a 40-day fast.
How gorgeous. How gorgeous.
And Vic's message to us was just one of many. Brad and Holly about went stir crazy.
Thank you, family, for all of you who sent us messages and warm greetings. Thank you so much. We have enjoyed our time off, but you're going to pay for it. Like the man said, we're going to tear Christianity a new one. I'm pretty sure that it's not going to be pretty.
Did I say that?
Yeah, I'm telling you. You said it out loud.
That sounds like Glenn Klein to me.
And thank you, family, for all of you who want to invest in this gospel. A gospel that, as I've often said, if you want to participate any way in the gospel, well, yep, go for your life, fill your boots. But know this, that what you're doing more than anything else is you are providing the means by which other people just like you are hearing the gospel for the first time and are saying, oh, wow. Now, there was a friend of mine, Tom Shannon, and Tom, if you're listening, kudos to you, mate. Tom wrote me just, I think it was, I don't remember what group it was in, but Tom wrote me and said, I think I've always felt the same way, and he was listening to Romans 9 and 10, recorded at Calgary earlier this year, or last year, and he said, I think that Mike and I might be twins. I've always thought this way, but Mike just has a different way of putting it. Family, thank you. Thank you on behalf of Tom and the countless others that you have brought the gospel into their lives. Thank you so much.
Yes.
And so it is that we must leave you, family and friends. If you'd like to know anything about the gospel revolution, well, you know, we may not tell you, but you can call our office on
832-318-9339.
And you might be surprised what we will share with you. And speak to us about how you want to participate or go to I only wear my teeth when I do this show. I go down the store and I'm an old, he's got a beard, a white beard and no teeth, the poor little fella. And Publix are great. They send the kids out with me to the car. All I need to complete the picture is a walking stick. Or go to www.gospelrevolution.com and hit the connect link. So now it's good night from myself, Don Bartlett, from the GR Studios in Cullman, Alabama.
And it's good night from Michael Williams right here in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. We love you guys. We are going full swing next week again into Pledge Drive. Calling me is not forbidden. You can call, you can even just text me and say, take this much money from me. So
there you go.
And we love you guys so much. We're looking forward to a very strong year in the gospel. It really is shaping up to be one. Thank you. We love you.
We sure hope you enjoyed today's podcast. And remember, we'll be here to do the same thing all over again next week, only I might have to play Elvira.
It's going to be better than Elvira.
Well, I'll play Elvira now and let's see. All right, Mike. Thanks, mate.
Yeah, that was fun.
It was.
And I think we're off to a good start.
An hour 20 we've been recording. That'll come down to about an hour 10 now, even an hour. Doesn't bother me anymore. And I know it doesn't bother you. But it's a good start, mate. Yeah.
It is a good start. All right. Have a wonderful, wonderful rest of your week.
DMV experience, yes.
Oh, yes, that's where you're going. All right, buddy, wear your teeth.
Okay. Okay. Bye-bye, mate.
Bye.
Will there be hippies in heaven? All with long hair and cowboy boots, keep us all out. Well, only the straights be living. Oh, will there be hippies in heaven? Judging books by their covers and offsprings by mother is too weird. Super weird, man. You know, DCs look AC, or ACs look DC with long beards. But the content of contentment just cannot be seen from the outside. And no one can tell if there's a Jekyll or Hyde on the inside. So, will there be hippies in heaven? Or will long hair and cowboy boots keep us all out? Will only the straights be the leaven? Or will there be hippies in heaven? Hating colors and creeds, judging desires and needs by our not me. That'd be bad. Have-nots and want-nots could possibly rather just be free, running free. In the course of our time, we've seen fine people found to be worthless, and some without stature be the salt of the earth in a true test. So, will there be hippies in heaven? All the long hair and cowboy boots keep their soul out. Will only the straights be the leaven? Or will there be hippies in heaven? Hey, will there be hippies in heaven? I certainly hope so. I really did want to go.
Gospel Revolution.